Chapter 17. Irving. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 13 November 1847. Silence was missing, and it was 3rd Lieutenant John Irving's job to find her. The captain hadn't ordered him to do so. Not exactly. But Captain Crozier had told Irving to watch over the Eskimo woman when the captains decided to keep her aboard HMS Terror 6 months earlier in June, and Captain Crozier never rescinded that order, so Irving felt responsible for her. Besides, the young man was in love with her. He knew it was foolish, insane even, to have fallen in love with a savage, a woman who was not even a Christian, and an uneducated native who couldn't speak a word of English, or any language for that matter, with her tongue torn out as it was. But Irving was still in love with her. Something about her made the tall, strong John Irving weak in his knees. And now she was gone. They first noticed she wasn't in her assigned berth, that little den set back amid the crates in the cluttered part of the lower deck just forward of the sick bay. On Thursday, 2 days earlier, but the men were used to Lady Silence's odd comings and goings. She was off the ship as much as she was on it, even at night. Irving reported to Captain Crozier on Thursday afternoon, the 11th of November, that Silence had gone missing. But the captain, Irving, and the others had seen her out on the ice 2 nights before. Then, after the remains of Strong and Evans had been found, she'd gone missing again. The captain said not to worry, that she'd show up. But she hadn't. The storm had blown in that Thursday morning, bringing heavy snow and high winds. Work teams, labouring by lantern light to repair the trail cairns between Terra and Erebus, 4-foot-high tapered columns of ice bricks every 30 paces, had been forced to return to the ships that afternoon and hadn't been able to work out on the ice since. The last messenger from Erebus, who had arrived late Thursday and been forced to stay on Terra because of the storm, confirmed that Silence was not aboard Commander Fitzjames's ship. By this Saturday morning, watch was being changed on deck every hour, and the men still came below crusted with ice and shaking with cold. Work parties had to be sent topside into the gale with axes every 3 hours to hack the ice off the remaining spars and lines so that the ship would not tip over from the weight. Also, the falling ice was a hazard to those on watch and did damage to the deck itself. More men struggled to shovel snow off the icy deck of the forward listing Terror before it built up to a depth where they couldn't get the hatches open. When Lieutenant Irving reported again to Captain Crozier on this Saturday night after supper that Silence was still missing, the captain said, "If she's out in this, she may not be coming back, John, but you have permission to search the entire ship tonight after most of the men are in their hammocks, if only to make sure she's gone." Even though Irving's officer on deck watch had ended hours earlier this evening, the lieutenant now got back into his cold weather slops, lit an oil lantern, and climbed the ladderway to the deck again. Conditions had not improved. If anything, they were worse than when Irving had gone below for supper 5 hours earlier. The wind howled in from the northwest, blowing snow before it and reducing visibility to 10 feet or less. Ice had recoated everything, even though there was a 5-man axe party hacking and shouting somewhere forward of the snow-laden canvas sagging above the hatchway. Irving struggled out through a foot of new spindrift under the canvas pyramid, lantern blowing back toward his face as he searched for one of the men not swinging an axe in the darkness. Reuben Mayle, captain of the forecastle, had watch and work party officer duty, and Irving found him by following the faint glow to the other man's lantern on the port side. Mayle was a snow-encrusted mound of wool. Even his face was hidden under a makeshift hood, wrapped about by layers of heavy wool comforters. The shotgun in the crook of his bulky arm was sheathed in ice. Both men had to shout to be heard.
"See anything, Mr. Mayle?"
shouted Lieutenant Irving, leaning close to the thick turban of wool that was the forecastle captain's head. The shorter man tugged down the scarf a bit. His nose was icicle white.
"You mean the ice party, sir? I can't see 'em once they get above the first spars. I just listened, sir, while I fill in for young Kinnaird's port watch duty. He was on the 3rd watch, shoveling party, sir, and still ain't thawed out."
"No, I mean on the ice," shouted Irving.
Mayle laughed. It was quite literally a muffled sound.
None of us have seen as far as the ice for 48 hours, Lieutenant. You know that, sir. You was out here earlier.
Irving nodded and wrapped his own comforter tighter around his forehead and lower face.
No one's seen Silence. Lady Silence?
What, sir?
Mr. Mayle leaned closer, the shotgun, a column of ice-rimmed metal and wood between them.
Lady Silence!
Shouted Irving.
No, sir. I understand that no one's seen the Eskimo woman for days. She must be gone, Lieutenant. Dead out there somewhere. Good riddance, I say.
Irving nodded, patted Mayle on his bulky shoulder with his own bulky mitten, and made his way around by the stern, staying away from the mainmast, where giant chunks of ice were falling out of the blowing snow and crashing like artillery shells onto the deck, to speak to John Bates, where the man stood watch on the starboard side. Bates had seen nothing. He hadn't even been able to see the five men of the Axe Party as they set to work.
Begging your pardon, sir, but I don't have no watch, and I'm afraid I won't hear the bell, what with all this chopping and falling, and the wind blowing and crashing of ice, sir. Is there much time left on this watch?
You'll hear the bell when Mr. Mayle rings it,
shouted Irving, leaning close to the ice-shrouded globe of wool that was the 26-year-old's head.
And he'll come round to check on you before going below. As you were, Bates.
Aye, sir.
The wind tried to knock Irving off his feet as he went around to the front of the canvas cover, waited for a break in the falling ice, hearing the men curse and shout in the main trees and thrumming rigging above. And then he hurried, as quickly as he could, through the 2 feet of new snow on deck, ducked under the frozen canvas, and clambered through the hatch and down the ladderway. He'd searched the lower decks multiple times, of course, especially behind the remaining crates forward of the sick bay, where the woman had previously had her little den, but now Irving walked aft. The ship was quiet this late at night, except for the stamping and crash of ice on the deck above, the snores from the exhausted men in their hammocks forward, Mr. Diggle's usual bangs and curses from the direction of the stove, and the ever-present howl of wind and grind of ice. Irving felt his way along the dark and narrow companionway. Except for Mr. Mayle's room, none of the sleeping cubicles here in officers' country were empty. HMS Terra had been lucky in that respect. While Erebus had lost several officers to that thing on the ice, including Sir John and Lieutenant Gore, none of Terra's officers, warrant officers, or petty officers had died yet, except for young John Torrington, the lead stoker, who died of natural causes a year and a half earlier, back at Beachy Island. No one was in the great cabin. It was rarely warm enough to tarry long there now, and even the leather-bound books looked cold on their shelves. The wooden instrument that played metal musical discs when cranked was silent these days. Irving had time to notice that Captain Crozier's lamp was still lit behind his partition before the lieutenant pushed forward through the officers' and mates' empty mess rooms and back to the ladderway. The orlop deck below was, as it always was, very cold and very dark. With fewer provision-carrying parties coming down here because of the severe rationing due to the many spoiled cans of food the surgeons had discovered, and with fewer coal-sack-hauling parties because of the dwindling coal supplies and reduced hours of heating for the ship, Irving found himself alone in the frigid space. The blackwood beams and frost-covered metal brackets groaned around him as he made his way forward before working his way back toward the stern. The lamplight seemed to be swallowed up by the thick darkness, and Irving had trouble seeing the faint glow through the fog of ice crystals created by his own breathing. Lady Silence was not in the bow area, not in the carpenter's storeroom or the bosun's storeroom, nor in the almost empty bread room aft of these closed compartments. The midship section of the orlop deck had been crammed deck to ceiling with crates, barrels, and other packages of supplies when Terra had sailed, but now much of the deck space was clear. Lady Silence was nowhere amidships. Lieutenant Irving let himself into the spirit room, using the key Captain Crozier had loaned him. There were brandy and wine bottles left. He could see by the glow of the dimming lantern, but he knew that the level of rum was low in the huge main cask. When the rum ran out, when the men's daily noon supply of grog disappeared, then, Lieutenant Irving knew, as all officers in the Royal Navy knew, mutiny would become a much more serious concern. Mr. Helpman, the captain's clerk, and Mr. Goddard, the captain of the hold, had reported recently that they estimated another 6 weeks or so of rum remained, and that much only if the standard 1/4 pint of rum in the gill, diluted with 3/4 pint of water, was reduced by half. The men would grumble even then. Irving did not think Lady Silence could have sneaked into the locked spirit room, despite all the whispering of the men about her witch-like powers, but he searched the space carefully, peering under tabletops and counters. The row upon row of cutlasses, sword bayonets, and muskets on the shelves above him glittered coldly in the lantern light. He went aft to the gunner's storeroom, with its adequate remaining supplies of powder and shot, peered into the captain's private storeroom. Only Crozier's few remaining whiskey bottles sat on the shelves, the food having been parceled out to the other officers in recent weeks. Then he searched the sail room, slop room, aft cable lockers, and mate's storeroom. If Lieutenant John Irving had been an Eskimo woman attempting to hide aboard the ship, he thought he might have chosen the sail room, with its mostly untouched heaps and rolls of spare canvas, sheets, and long unused sailing gear. But she was not there. Irving had a start in the slop room when his lantern showed a tall, silent figure standing in the rear of the room, shoulders looming against a dark bulkhead. But it turned out to be only some wool greatcoats and a Welsh wig hanging on a peg. Locking doors behind him, the lieutenant went down the ladder to the hold. Third Lieutenant John Irving, although appearing younger than his years because of his boyish blonde looks and quick blush, was not in love with the Eskimo woman because he was a lovesick virgin. Actually, Irving had had more experience with the fairer sex than many of those braggarts on the ship who filled the forecastle with tales of their sexual conquests. Irving's uncle had brought him down to the Bristol docks when the boy turned 14, introduced him to a clean and pleasant dockside whore named Moll, and paid for the experience. Not merely a quick back-alley knee-wobbler, but a proper evening and night and morning in a clean room under the eaves of an old inn overlooking the quay. It had given young John Irving a taste for the physical, which he had indulged many times since. Nor had Irving had less luck with the ladies in polite society. He had courted the youngest daughter of Bristol's third most important family, the Dunwit Harrisons, and that lass, Emily, had allowed, even initiated, personal intimacies most young men would have sold their left bollock to have experienced at such an age. Upon arriving in London to complete his naval education in artillery on the gunnery training vessel HMS Excellent, Irving had spent his weekends meeting, courting, and enjoying the company of several attractive upper-class young ladies, including the obliging Miss Sarah, the shy but ultimately surprising Miss Linda, and the truly shocking, in private, Miss Abigail Elizabeth Lindstrom Hyde Berry, with whom the fresh-faced third lieutenant soon found himself engaged to be married. John Irving had no intention of being married, at least not while he was in his 20s. His father and uncle had both taught him that these were the years in which he should see the world and sow wild oats, and most probably not when he was in his 30s. He saw no compelling reason to marry while he would be in his 40s. So, although Irving had never once considered the Discovery Service, he had never enjoyed cold weather, and the thought of being frozen in at either of the poles was both absurd and appalling to him. The week after he awoke to find himself engaged, the third lieutenant followed the promptings of his older chums George Hodgson and Fred Hornby and went along to an interview on HMS Terror to apply for transfer. Captain Crozier, obviously in foul spirits and hungover that beautiful spring Saturday morning, had glowered, harrumphed, scowled, and quizzed them carefully. He laughed at their gunnery training on a mastless ship and demanded to know just how they could be of service on an expedition sailing ship which carried only small arms. Then he asked them pointedly if they would do their duty as Englishmen, whatever on earth that meant, Irving remembered thinking, when said Englishmen were locked into a frozen sea 1,000 miles from home, and promptly assured them of berths. Miss Abigail Elizabeth Lindstrom Hyde Berry was distraught, of course, and shocked that their engagement should be extended over months or actual years. But Lieutenant Irving consoled her first with assurances that the extra money from the Discovery Service duty would be an absolute necessity for them, and then by explaining his need for the adventure, and then fame and glory that might well come from writing a book upon his return, Her family understood these priorities, even if Miss Abigail did not. Then, when they were alone, he coaxed her out of her tears and anger with hugs, kisses, and expert caresses. The consolation grew to interesting heights. Lieutenant Irving knew that he might well be a father by now, 2.5 years after the consoling. But he had not been unhappy to wave goodbye to Miss Abigail some weeks later as Terror slipped her moorings and was pushed away by 2 steam tugs. The disconsolate young lady stood on the docks at Greenhithe in her green and pink silk dress under a pink parasol and waved her matching silk pink handkerchief, using another less expensive cotton handkerchief to dry her copious tears. He knew that Sir John fully expected to stop in both Russia and China after negotiating the Northwest Passage, so Lieutenant Irving had already made plans to transfer to a Royal Navy ship assigned to one of those waters, or perhaps even resign from the Navy, write his adventure book and look after his uncle's silk and millinery interests in Shanghai. The hold was darker and colder than the Orlop deck. Irving hated the hold. It reminded him, even more than did his freezing berth, or the dimly lit, freezing lower deck of a grave. He only came down here when he had to, mostly to supervise the stowing of shrouded dead bodies, or the parts of dead bodies, in the locked dead room. Each time he wondered if someone soon would be supervising the stowing of his corpse down here. He lifted his lantern and headed aft through the slush melt and thick air. The boiler room appeared to be empty, but then Lieutenant Irving saw the body on the cot near the starboard bulkhead. No lantern glowed, only the low red flicker through the grate of one of the 4 closed boiler doors, and in the dim light, the long body stretched out on the cot looked dead. The man's open eyes stared up at the low ceiling and he did not blink. Nor did he turn his head when Irving came into the room and hung his lantern on a hook near the coal scuttle.
"What brings you down here, Lieutenant?"
asked James Thompson. The engineer still neither moved his head nor blinked. Some time in the past month he had quit shaving, and whiskers now sprouted everywhere on his thin, white face. The man's eyes lay deep in dark sockets. His hair was wild and spiky with soot and sweat. It was near freezing even here in the boiler room with the fires damped so low, but Thompson was lying only in his trousers, undershirt, and suspenders.
"I'm looking for silence," said Irving.
The man on the cot continued to stare at the deck above him.
"Lady Silence," clarified the young lieutenant.
"The Eskimo witch," said the engineer.
Irving cleared his throat. The cold dust was so thick here that it was hard to breathe.
"Have you seen her, Mr. Thompson, or heard anything unusual?"
Thompson, who still had not blinked or turned his head, laughed softly. The sound was disturbing, a rattle of small stones in a jar, and it ended in a cough.
"Listen," said the engineer.
Irving turned his head. There were only the usual noises, although louder down here in the dark hold, the slow moan of ice pressing in, the louder groaning of the iron tanks and structural reinforcements fore and aft of the boiler room, the more distant moan of the blizzard winds far above, the crash of falling ice carried down as vibration through the ship's timbers, the thrum of the masts being shaken in their sockets, random scratching noises from the hull, and a constant hiss, screech, and claw-sliding noise from the boiler and pipes all around.
"There's someone or something else breathing on this deck," continued Thompson. "Do you hear it?"
Irving strained, but heard no breathing, although the boiler sounded like something large, panting hard.
"Where are Smith and Johnson?" asked the lieutenant.
These were the 2 stokers who worked round the clock here with Thompson. The supine engineer shrugged.
"With so little coal to shovel these days, I need them only a few hours a day. I spend most of my time alone, crawling among the pipes and valves, lieutenant. Patching, taping, replacing, trying to keep this thing working, moving hot water through the lower deck for a few hours each day. In 2 months, 3 at the most, it will all be academic. We already have no coal to steam. We'll soon have no coal to heat."
Irving had heard these reports in the officer's mess, but had little interest in the subject. 3 months seemed a lifetime away. Right now, he had to make sure Silence was not on board and report to the captain. Then he had to try and find her if she was not aboard Terra. Then he had to survive another 3 months. He would worry about shortages of coal later.
"Have you heard the rumors, Lieutenant?" asked the engineer. The long form on the couch still had neither blinked nor turned his head to look at Irving.
"No, Mr. Thompson. Which rumor?"
"That the thing on the ice, the apparition, the devil, comes into the ship whenever it wants to, and walks the hold deck late at night," said Thompson.
"No," said Lieutenant Irving, "I've not heard that."
"Stay down here alone on the hold deck through enough watches," said the man on the cot, "and you'll hear and see everything."
"Good night, Mr. Thompson." Irving took his sputtering lantern and went back out into the companionway and forward. There were few places left to search on the hold deck, and Irving had every intention of making a fast job of it. The dead room was locked. The lieutenant had not asked his captain for the key, and after inspecting that the heavy lock was solid and secured, he moved on. He didn't want to see what was causing the scrabbling and chewing sounds he could hear through the thick oak door. The 21 huge iron water tanks along the hull offered no place for an Eskimo to hide, so Irving went into the coal bunkers, his lantern dimming in the thick coal dust-blackened air. The remaining sacks of coal, once filling each bin and stacked from hull bottom to the deck beams above, merely lined the edge of each sooty room like low barriers of sandbags now. He couldn't imagine Lady Silence making a new shelter in one of these lightless, reeking, pestilential hellholes. The decks were awash in sewage, and rats scuttled everywhere. But he had to look. When he was finished searching the coal storage lockers and the stores amidships, Lieutenant Irving moved out into the remaining crates and barrels in the forepeak, directly below the crew's berthing area, and Mr. Diggle's huge stove, 2 decks above. A narrower ladder came down through the orlop deck to this stores area, and tons of lumber were hanging from the heavy beams overhead, turning the space into a maze and requiring the lieutenant to proceed in a half crouch. But there were far fewer crates, barrels, and heaps of goods than there had been 2.5 years earlier. But more rats. Many more. Searching between and in some of the larger crates, glancing to make sure that the barrels awash in the slush were either empty or sealed, Irving had just stepped around the vertical forward ladder when he saw a flash of white and heard harsh breathing, gasps, and caught a rustle of frenzied movement just beyond the dim circle of the lantern light. It was large, moving, and was not the woman. Irving had no weapon. For the briefest instant, he considered dropping the lantern and running back through the darkness toward the midship ladderway. He did not, of course, and the thought was gone almost before it was formed. He took a step forward and, in a voice stronger and more authoritative than he thought he might be capable of right then, shouted, "Who goes there? Identify yourself." Then he saw them in the lantern light. The idiot, Magnus Manson, the largest man on the expedition, struggling back into his trousers, his huge, grimy fingers fumbling with buttons. A few feet away, Cornelius Hickey, the caulker's mate, barely 5 feet tall, beady-eyed and ferret-faced, was pulling his suspenders into place. John Irving's mouth hung open. It took several seconds for the reality of what he was looking at to filter through his mind toward acceptance. Sodomites. He had heard of such goings-on, of course, had joked with his mates about such things, had once witnessed a flogging around the fleet when an ensign on the Excellent had confessed to such doings. But Irving had never thought that he would be on a ship where to serve with men who... Manson, the giant, was taking an ominous step toward him. The man was so large that everywhere below decks he had to walk in a stooped crouch to avoid the beams, giving him an habitual hunchbacked shuffle that he used even in the open air. Now, his huge hands glowing in the lamplight, he looked like an executioner advancing on a condemned man.
"Magnus," said Hickey.
"No."
Irving's jaw dropped farther. Were these sodomites threatening him? The prescribed sentence for sodomy on a ship of Her Majesty's Navy was hanging, with 200 lashes from the cat while being flogged around the fleet, literally from ship to ship in harbour, being considered great leniency.
How dare you,
said Irving, although whether he was talking about Manson's threatening attitude or their unnatural act, even he did not know.
Lieutenant,
said Hickey, words rushing in that flute-high rush of the Calker's mate's Liverpool accent.
Begging your pardon, sir. Mr. Diggle sent us down for some flour, sir. One of them damn rats rushed up Seaman Manson's trouser leg, sir, and we was trying to set it right. Filthy buggers, them rats.
Irving knew that Mr. Diggle had not yet started the late-night baking of biscuits and that there was ample flour in the cook's stores up on the lower deck. Hickey was not even trying to make his lie convincing. The little man's beady, evaluating eyes reminded Irving of the rats scurrying in the darkness around them.
We'd appreciate it if you wouldn't tell no one, sir,
continued the Calker's mate.
Magnus here would hate to be made fun of for being afraid of a little rat running up his leg.
The words were a challenge and a defiance, almost a command. Insolence came off the little man in waves, while Manson stood there, empty-eyed, as dumb as a beast of burden, huge hands still flexed, passively awaiting the next command from his diminutive lover. The silence between the men stretched. Ice moaned against the ship. Timbers creaked. Rats scurried close by.
Get out of here, Irving said at last. Now!
Aye, sir. Thank you, sir,
said Hickey. He unshielded a small lantern that had been on the deck near him.
Come, Magnus.
The two men scrambled up the narrow forward ladder into the darkness of the orlop deck. Lieutenant Irving stood where he was for several long minutes, listening to, but not hearing the groans and snaps of the ship. The blizzard howl was like a distant dirge. If he reported this to Captain Crozier, there would be a trial. Manson, the village idiot of this expedition, was well liked by the crew, however much they teased him about his fear of ghosts and goblins. The man did the heavy work of any three of his comrades. Hickey, while not especially liked by any of the other warrant or regular officers, was respected by the regular seamen for his abilities to get his friends extra tobacco, an extra gill of rum, or an article of needed clothing. Crozier wouldn't hang either man, thought John Irving, but the captain had been in an especially foul mood in recent weeks, and the punishments could be dramatic. Everyone on the ship knew that just weeks ago, the captain threatened to lock Manson into the dead room with his chum Walker's rat-chewed corpse if the huge idiot ever again refused an order to carry coal on the hold deck. No one would be surprised if he carried out that sentence now. On the other hand, thought the lieutenant, what had he just seen? What could he testify to, his hand on the Holy Bible, if there were an actual court of inquiry? He hadn't seen any unnatural act. He'd not caught the two sodomites in the act of copulation, or any other unnatural posture. Irving had heard the breathing, the gasps, something that must have been whispered alarm at the approach of his lantern, and then seen the two struggling to raise their trousers and tuck in their shirts. That would be enough to get one or both of them hanged under normal circumstances. But here, stuck in the ice, with months or years ahead of them before any chance of rescue? For the first time in many years, John Irving felt like sitting down and weeping. His life had just become complex beyond all his imagining. If he did report the two sodomites, none of his crewmates, officers, friends, subordinates would ever look at him quite the same way again. If he did not report the two men, he would open himself to endless insolence from Hickey. His cowardice in not reporting the man would expose Irving to a form of blackmail for weeks and months to come. Nor would the lieutenant ever sleep well again, or feel comfortable on watch in the darkness outside, or in his cubicle, as comfortable as anyone could be with that monstrous white thing killing them all one by one, waiting, as he would be now, for Manson's white hands to close around his throat.
Oh, bugger me, Irving said aloud, into the creaking cold of the hold.
Realizing exactly what he had said, he laughed aloud, the laugh sounding stranger, weaker, yet more ominous than the words. Having looked everywhere except a few hogshead barrels and the forward cable locker, he was ready to give up his search. But he didn't want to go up to the lower deck until Hickey and Manson were out of sight. Irving made his way past floating, empty crates. The water was above his ankles here, this far toward the downward tilting bow, and his soaked boots broke through the scrim of ice. Another few minutes and he'd have frostbitten toes for sure. The cable locker was at the most forward part of the forepeak, right where the hull came together at the bow. It was not really a room. The two doors were only 3 feet tall, and the space within not much more than 4 feet high, but rather a place to stow the heavy houses used for the bow anchors. The cable locker always stank to high heaven of river and estuary mud, even months or years after a ship's weighing anchor from that place. It never fully lost its stench, and the massive houses, coiled and overlapping, left little or no free room in the low, black, evil-smelling space. Lieutenant Irving pried open the reluctant doors to the locker and held his lantern to the opening. The grinding of the ice was especially loud here, where the bow and bowsprit were pressed into the shifting pack ice itself. Lady Silence's head shot up, and her dark eyes reflected the light like a cat's. She was naked, except for white-brown furs spread under her like a rug, and another heavy fur, perhaps her parka, draped over her shoulders and naked body. The floor of the cable locker was raised more than a foot above the flooded deck outside. She had molded and shoved the massive houses aside until the space opened made a low, fur-lined cave within the overhanging tangle of huge hemp ropes. A small food can filled with oil or blubber provided light and heat from an open flame. The Eskimo woman was in the process of eating a haunch of red, raw, bloody meat. She was slicing directly from the meat to her mouth with quick cuts from a short but obviously very sharp knife. The knife had a bone or antler handle with some sort of design on it. Lady Silence was on her knees, leaning forward over the flame and the meat, and her small breasts hung down in a way that reminded the literate Lieutenant Irving of pictures he had seen of the statue of a she-wolf nursing the infants Romulus and Remus. "I'm terribly sorry, madam," said Irving. He touched his cap and shut the doors. Staggering back a few steps in the slush, sending rats scurrying, the lieutenant tried to think through shock for the second time in 5 minutes. The captain had to know about Silence's hiding place. The fire danger alone from the open flame there would have to be dealt with. But where had she got the knife? It looked like something made by Eskimos, rather than a weapon or tool from the ship. Certainly they had searched her 6 months ago in June. Could she have hidden it all this time? What else could she be hiding? And the fresh meat. There was no fresh meat on board. Irving was sure of that. Could she have been hunting? In the winter and blizzard and dark? And hunting what? The only things out there on the ice, or under the ice, were the white bears and the things stalking the men of Erebus and Terra. John Irving had a terrible thought. For a second, he was tempted to go back and test the lock to the dead room. Then he had an even more terrible thought. Only half of William Strong and Thomas Evans had been found. Lieutenant John Irving stumbled aft, feet sliding on the ice and slush, as he fumbled and felt his way toward the central ladderway to fight his way up and out, toward the light of the lower deck. Chapter 18. Good Sir. Latitude 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. 20 November, 1847. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir.
Saturday, 20 November, 1847. We do not have enough food to survive another winter and summer here in the ice. We should have had. Sir John had provisioned the two ships for 3 years at extraordinarily full rations for all hands. 5 years for reduced, but still adequate rations for men doing heavy work each day, and 7 years with serious rationing, but adequate for all men. By Sir John's calculations, and those of his ship's captains, Crozier and Fitzjames, HMSs Erebus and Terror should have been amply provisioned until the year 1852. Instead, we shall be running out of our last edible supplies sometime next spring. And should we all perish because of this, the reason is murder. Dr. MacDonald on Terra had been suspicious of the canned food supplies for some time, and he shared his concerns with me after the death of Sir John. Then the problem with spoiled and poisonous canned foods on our first outing to King William Land last summer, tins removed from a deeper part of stores beneath deck, confirmed the problem. In October, the four of us surgeons petitioned Captain Crozier and Commander Fitzjames to allow us to take a full inventory. Then the four of us, aided by crewmen assigned to help us move the hundreds upon hundreds of crates, barrels and heavy cans in both lower decks, all up decks and holds, and to open and test selected samplings, had done the inventory twice, so as not to make a mistake. More than half the canned food aboard both ships is worthless. We reported this 3 weeks ago to both captains in Sir John's large and freezing former cabin. Fitzjames, while nominally still a mere commander, is called captain by Crozier, the new expedition leader, and others follow suit. In the secret meeting were the four of us surgeons, Fitzjames and Crozier. Captain Crozier, I have to remember that he is Irish after all, flew into a rage the likes of which I have never seen. He demanded a full explanation, as if we surgeons had been responsible for the stores and victuals on the Franklin expedition. Fitzjames, on the other hand, had always had his doubts about the canned goods and the victualler who had canned them. The only member of the expedition or the Admiralty who seems to have expressed such reservations. But Crozier remained incredulous that such an act of criminal fraud could have been carried out on ships of the Royal Navy. John Peddy, Crozier's chief surgeon on Terra, has seen the most sea duty of any of us four medical officers, but most of it had been aboard HMS Mary, along with Crozier's bosun John Lane, and that was in the Mediterranean, where very little of the ship's stores had consisted of canned goods. Similarly, my nominal superior on Erebus, Chief Surgeon Stephen Stanley, had little experience with such great quantities of canned provisions aboard ship. Sensitive to the various diets thought necessary to prevent scurvy, Dr. Stanley was shocked into speechlessness when our inventory suggested via sampling that almost half the remaining tins of food, vegetables, meat and soup may well be contaminated or otherwise ruined. Only Dr. MacDonald, who had worked with Mr. Helpman, Captain Crozier's clerk in charge, during the provisioning, had his theories. As I recorded some months ago in this journal, besides the 10,000 cases of preserved cooked meats aboard Erebus, our tinned rations include boiled and roast mutton, veal, a wide variety of vegetables including potatoes, carrots and parsnips, various types of soups, and 9,450 pounds of chocolate. Alex MacDonald had been our expedition's medical liaison, with the captain superintendent of the Deptford Victualling Yard, and with a certain Mr. Stephen Goldner, our expedition's victualling contractor. MacDonald reminded Captain Crozier in October that four contractors had put in bids to provide canned ship stores for Sir John's expedition, the firms of Hogarth, Gamble, Cooper and Aves, and that of the aforementioned Mr. Goldner. Dr. MacDonald reminded the captain, and astonished the rest of us, by reporting that Goldner's bid was only half that of the other three, much better known victuallers. In addition, while the other contractors set a schedule of delivering the food in a month or 3 weeks, Goldner had promised immediate delivery, with the crating and drayage thrown in for no charge. Such immediate delivery was impossible, of course, and Goldner's bid would have required him to lose a fortune if the food had been the quality advertised, and cooked and prepared in the ways advertised. But no one except Captain Fitzjames appears to have taken notice of this. The Admiralty and the three commissioners of the Discovery Service, everyone involved in the selection, except for the experienced comptroller of the Deptford Victualling Yard, immediately recommended accepting Goldner's offer at a full payment value, or more than £3,800. A fortune for any man, but especially for the foreigner that MacDonald explained Goldner to be. The man's only canning factory, Alex said, was in Galatz, Malavia. Goldner was given one of the largest consignments in the history of the Admiralty, 9,500 cans of meats and vegetables in sizes weighing 1 to 8 pounds, as well as 20,000 cans of soup. MacDonald had brought one of Goldner's handbills. Fitzjames recognized it at once, and looking over it made my mouth water. 7 kinds of mutton, 14 preparations of veal, 13 kinds of beef, 4 varieties of lamb. There were listings for jugged hare, ptarmigan, rabbit in onion sauce or curried, pheasant, and half a dozen other varieties of game. If the Discovery Service wished to have seafood, Goldner had offered to provide canned lobsters in the shell, cod, West Indian turtle, salmon steaks, and Yarmouth bloaters. For fine dining, at only 15 pence, Goldner's handbill offered truffled pheasant, calves tongue sauce piquante, and beef à la Flamande. In reality, said Dr. MacDonald, we're used to receiving salt horse in a harness cask. I had been at sea long enough to recognize the terms. Horse flesh substituted for beef until the sailors called the barrels a harness cask. But they ate the salted meat readily enough. Goldner cheated us much worse than that, continued MacDonald in front of a livid Captain Crozier and an angrily nodding Commander Fitzjames. He substituted cheap foods under labels that sold for much more on the handbill. Regular stewed beef under a label reading stewed rump steaks, for instance. The former is listed at 9 pence, but he charged 14 pence by changing the label.
Good God, man! Exploded Crozier. Every victualler does that to the Admiralty. Cheating the Navy is as old as Adam's foreskin. That can't explain why we're suddenly almost out of food.
No, Captain, continued MacDonald. It's the cooking and soldering.
The what?
Demanded the Irishman, obviously trying to keep his temper in check. Crozier's face was crimson and white under his battered cap.
The cooking and soldering, said Alex.
As to the cooking, Mr. Goldner bragged of a patented process in which he adds a large dose of nitrate of soda, calcium chloride, into the huge vats of boiling water to increase the processing temperature, primarily to speed production.
What's wrong with that? Demanded Crozier.
The cans were overdue as it was. Something needed to be done to build a fire under Goldner's arse. His patented process hurried things up.
Yes, Captain, said Dr. MacDonald, but the fire under Goldner's arse was hotter than the fire under these meats, vegetables, and other foods that were hurriedly cooked before canning. Many of us in the medical field believe that proper cooking of food rids it of noxious influences that can cause disease. But I myself witnessed Goldner's cooking processes, and he simply did not cook the meat, vegetables, and soups long enough.
Why didn't you report this to the Discovery Service commissioners?
Snapped Crozier.
He did, Captain Fitzjames said tiredly.
So did I. But the only one who listened was the comptroller of the Deptford Yard Victualling Service, and he had no vote on the final commission.
So you're saying that more than half our food has gone bad in the last 3 years because of poor cooking methods?
Crozier's countenance continued to be a mottle of crimson and white.
Yes, said Alex MacDonald, but equally to blame, we think, is the soldering.
The soldering of the cans? Asked Fitzjames. His doubts about Goldner evidently had not extended to this technicality.
Yes, Commander, said Terror's assistant surgeon. Preserving food in tins is a recent innovation, an amazing part of our modern age.
But we know enough in the past few years of its use to know that proper soldering the flange along the seams of the cylindrical body of the can is important if the foodstuffs within are not to turn putrid.
And Goldner's people did not properly solder these tins? Asked Crozier. His voice was a low, menacing growl.
Not in about 60% of the tins we've inspected, said MacDonald. The gaps in the careless soldering have resulted in incomplete seams. The incomplete seams appear to have accelerated the putrefaction of our tinned beef, veal, vegetables, soups, and other foodstuffs.
How? Asked Captain Crozier.
He was shaking his broad head like a man who has been stunned by a physical blow. We've been in polar waters since shortly after the two ships left England. I thought it was cold enough up here to preserve anything until Judgment Day.
Apparently not, said MacDonald.
Many of Goldner's remaining 29,000 cans of food have ruptured. Others are already swelling from the gases caused by internal putrefaction. Perhaps some noxious vapours entered the tins in England. Perhaps there is some microscopic animalcule of which medicine and science are not yet aware, which invaded the tins during transit, or even at Goldner's victualling factory. Rosia frowned more deeply.
Animalcule?
Let's avoid the fantastic here, Mr. MacDonald. The assistant surgeon only shrugged. Perhaps it is fantastical, Captain, but you have not spent the hundreds of hours straining at the eyepiece of a microscope such as I have. We have little understanding of what any of these animalcules are, but I assure you that if you saw how many are present in a single drop of drinking water, you would be deeply sobered.
Prosia's coloration had calmed somewhat, but he blushed again at the comment which might have been a reflection of his frequently less than sober state.
All right. Some of the food is ruined, he said brusquely. What can we do to make sure the rest is safe for the men's consumption?
I cleared my throat. As you know, Captain, the men's summer diet included a daily ration of 1.25 pounds of salt meat, with vegetables consisting of only 1 pint of peas and 3/4 pound of barley a week. But they received their daily bread and biscuits. When we went into winter quarters, the flour ration was cut back 25% on the baking of bread, so as to conserve coal. If we could just begin cooking the remaining canned food rations longer, and renewing the baking of bread, it would help not only in preventing the fouled meats in the canned goods from threatening our health, but also help in the prevention of scurvy.
Impossible, snapped Crozier. We barely have enough coal left to heat both ships until April as it is. If you doubt me, ask Engineer Gregory or Engineer Thompson here on Terra.
I don't doubt you, Captain, I said sadly. I've spoken to both engineers, but without a resumption of extended cooking of the remaining canned goods, our chances of being poisoned are very high. All we can do is throw out the obviously ruined canned foods and avoid the many poorly soldered cans. This cuts down on our remaining stores most dramatically.
What about the ether stoves?
Asked FitzJames, brightening a bit.
We could use the camping stoves to heat the tinned soups and other doubtful provisions.
It was MacDonald who shook his head. We tested that, Commander. Dr. Goodsir and I experimented with heating some of the canned so-called beef stew on the patented cooking apparatus spirit stoves. The pint-sized bottles of ether do not last long enough to thoroughly heat the food, and the temperatures are low. Also, our sledge parties, or all of us, should we be forced to abandon ship, will be dependent upon the spirit stoves to melt snow and ice for drinking water once we are on the ice. We should preserve the ether spirits.
I was with Lieutenant Gore on our first sledge party to King William Land, and we used the spirit stoves daily, I added softly. The men used just enough ether and flame to get the canned soups to bubble a bit before digging in ravenously. The food was barely tepid. There was a long silence.
You report that over half the canned food we had been counting on to get through the next year or two, if necessary, is ruined, Crozier said at last. We don't have the coal to recook this food on either Erebus's or Terra's large Fraser's patent stoves, nor on the smaller whaleboat iron stoves, and you tell me that there is insufficient fuel to use the ether spirit stoves. What can we do?
All five of us, the four surgeons and Captain FitzJames, remained silent. The only answer was to abandon ship and seek out a more hospitable clime, preferably ashore somewhere south where we might shoot fresh game. As if reading our collective minds, Crozier smiled. It was a uniquely mad Irish smile, I thought at the time, and said,
The problem, gentlemen, is that there's not a man aboard either ship, not even one of our venerable marines, who knows how to catch or kill a seal or walrus, should those creatures ever grace us with their presence again, nor with the experience of shooting large game such as caribou, of which we have seen none.
The rest of us remained silent.
Thank you for your diligence, effort at doing the inventory, and excellent report, Mr. Peddy, Mr. Goodsir, Mr. MacDonald, and Mr. Stanley. We shall continue separating the cans you consider fully soldered and safe from those insufficiently soldered or bloated, distended, or otherwise visibly putrid. We shall stay on the current 2/3 rations until after Christmas Day, at which time I shall instigate a more draconian rationing plan.
Dr. Stanley and I pulled on our many layers of winter slops, and we went up to the deck to watch Mr. Peddy, Dr. MacDonald, Captain Crozier, and an honor guard of 4 seamen armed with shotguns begin their long trek back to Terra in the dark. As their lanterns and torches disappeared in the blowing snow, and the wind howled in the rigging,
the roar mixing with the constant grind and groan of the ice working against Erebus's hull, Stanley leaned close and shouted into my muffled ear. It would be a blessing if they missed the cairns and got lost on the way back, or if the thing on the ice got them tonight. I could only turn and stare in horror at the chief surgeon.
Death by starvation is a terrible thing, good sir, continued Stanley. Trust me, I've seen it in London, and I've seen it with shipwreck. Death by scurvy is worse. It would be better if the thing took us all tonight.
And with that, we went below to the flame-flickering darkness of the lower deck, and to a cold almost the equal of the Dante-esque Ninth Circle Arctic night without.
Chapter 19. Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 5 December 1847. On a Tuesday dog watch in the third week of November, the thing from the ice came aboard Erebus and took the well-liked bosun, Mr. Thomas Terry, snatching him from his post near the stern, leaving only the man's head on the railing. There had been no blood at Terry's stern watchpost, no blood on the ice-covered deck or on the hull. The conclusion was that the thing had taken Terry, carried him hundreds of yards out into the darkness where the seracs rose like trees of ice in a thick white forest, murdered and dismembered him, perhaps eaten him, although the men were growing increasingly doubtful that the white thing killing their crewmates and officers was actually doing so for food. And then it returned Mr. Terry's head before the starboard or port watchman noticed that the bosun had gone missing. The men who found the bosun's head at the end of that watch spent the week telling and retelling the others about poor Mr. Terry's visage, jaws open wide as if frozen in the middle of a scream, lips pulled back from his teeth, eyes protruding. There was not a tooth wound or claw mark on his face or head, only the ragged tearing at the neck, the thin pipe of his esophagus protruding like a rat's grey tail, and the stump of white spinal cord showing. Suddenly, the more than 100 surviving seamen found religion. Most of the men aboard Erebus had grumbled for 2 years about Sir John Franklin's endless divine services, but now, even the men who wouldn't have recognized a Bible if they'd wakened next to one after a 3-day drunk found a deep need for some sort of spiritual reassurance. As word of Thomas Terry's beheading spread, Captain Fitzjames had put the sail-wrapped bundle in Erebus's own sealed dead room down on the hold deck. The men began requesting a single Sunday service for both crews. It was ferret-faced Cornelius Hickey who came to Crozier late on Friday night with the request. Hickey had been on a torchlight work party, repairing ice cairns between the ships, and had spoken to the men from Erebus.
"It's unanimous, sir,"
said the Calker's mate as he stood in the doorway of Captain Crozier's tiny cabin.
"All the men would like a combined divine service. Both ships, Captain."
"You speak for every man on both ships?" Crozier asked.
"Aye, sir, I do,"
said Hickey, flashing a once winning smile that now showed only 4 of his remaining 6 teeth. The little Calker's mate was nothing if not confident.
"I doubt it," said Crozier, "but I'll talk to Captain Fitzjames and let you know about the service. Whatever we decide, you can be our appointed courier to tell all the men."
Crozier had been drinking when Hickey rapped on his door, and he'd never liked the officious little man. Every ship had sea lawyers. Like rats, they were a fact of naval life, and Hickey, despite his bad grammar and total lack of formal education, struck Crozier as the kind of sea lawyer that on a difficult voyage soon began fomenting actual mutiny.
"One of the reasons we'd all of us like a service such as that what Sir John, God bless and rest his soul, Captain, used to provide is that all of us..."
"That will be all, Mr. Hickey."
Crozier drank heavily that week. The melancholia that usually hovered over him like a fog now lay on him like a heavy blanket. He'd known Terry,
and thought him a more than capable bosun, and it was certainly a horrible enough way to die. But the Arctic, at either pole, offered a myriad of horrible enough ways to die. So did the Royal Navy during peacetime or war. Crozier had witnessed more than a few of these horrible ways to die during his long career. So while Mr. Terry's death was among the more uncanny he'd personally known, and the recent plague of violent deaths more frightening than any real plague he'd seen aboard ships, what brought on Crozier's deeper melancholy was more the reaction of the surviving members of the expedition. James Fitzjames, the hero of the Euphrates, seemed to be losing heart. He was made a hero by the press even before his first ship had left Liverpool, when young Fitzjames had plunged overboard to rescue a drowning customs agent, even though the handsome young officer was, as the Times said, embarrassed by a greatcoat, hat, and a very valuable watch. The merchants of Liverpool, knowing the value, as Crozier well knew, of a customs officer who was already bought and paid for, had rewarded young Fitzjames with an engraved silver plate. The Admiralty had taken notice, first of the silver plate, then of Fitzjames's heroism. Although in Crozier's experience, an officer rescuing a drowning man was an almost weekly occurrence, since few sailors knew how to swim. And finally, of the fact that Fitzjames was the handsomest man in the Navy, as well as a well-bred young gentleman. It hadn't hurt the rising young officer's reputation that he had twice volunteered to lead raiding parties against Bedouin bandits. Crozier noticed in the official reports that Fitzjames had broken his leg in one such foray, and been captured by the bandits in the second adventure. But the handsomest man in the Navy had managed to escape, which made Fitzjames all the more the hero to the London press and the Admiralty. Then came the Opium Wars, and in 1841, Fitzjames showed himself to be a real hero, being commended by his captain and by the Admiralty no fewer than 5 times. The dashing lad, 29 at the time, had used rockets to drive the Chinese off the hilltops at Cheki and Seguan, used rockets again to drive them out of Chapu, fought ashore at the Battle of Wusung, and returned to his expertise with rockets during the capture of Qingqiangfu. Seriously wounded, Lieutenant Fitzjames had managed on crutches and in bandages to attend the Chinese surrender at the signing of the Treaty of Nanking. Promoted to commander at the tender age of 30, the handsomest man in the Navy had been given command of the sloop of war HMS Clio, and his bright future seemed assured. But then, in 1844, the Opium Wars ended, and, as always happened to rising prospects in the Royal Navy, when treacherous peace suddenly broke out, Fitzjames found himself without a command, on shore and on half pay. Francis Crozier knew that if the Discovery Service offer of command to Sir John Franklin had been a godsend to the largely discredited old man, the offer of effective command of HMS Erebus had been a shining second chance to Fitzjames. But now, the handsomest man in the Navy had lost his pink cheeks and usual ebullient humour, while most of the officers and men were maintaining their weight even on 2/3 rations, for members of the Discovery Service received a richer diet than 99% of Englishmen ashore. Commander, now Captain James Fitzjames, had lost more than 2 stone. His uniform hung loosely on him. His boyish curls now fell limp from under his cap or Welsh wig. Fitzjames's face, always a bit too chubby, now appeared drawn, wan, and hollow-cheeked in the light from the oil lamps or hanging lanterns. The commander's public demeanour, which was always an easy mix of self-effacing humour and firm command, remained the same, but in private, with only Crozier in attendance, Fitzjames spoke less, smiled less frequently, and too often looked distracted and miserable. For a melancholy man like Crozier, the signs were obvious. At times it was like staring into a looking glass, except for the fact that the melancholy countenance staring back was a proper, lisping English gentleman rather than an Irish nobody. On Friday, the 3rd of December, Crozier loaded a shotgun and made the long solo walk through the cold darkness between Terra and Erebus,
if the thing on the ice wanted to take him, Crozier thought. A few more men with guns would make little difference in the outcome. It hadn't for Sir John. Crozier arrived safely. He and FitzJames discussed the situation, the men's morale, the requests for a religious service, the situation with the food tins, and the need to enforce strict rationing soon after Christmas. And they agreed that a combined divine service on the following Sunday might be a good idea. Since there were no chaplains or self-appointed ministers aboard, Sir John had filled both those roles until the previous June. Both captains would give a sermon. Crozier hated this task more than dockside dentistry, but realized that it had to be done. The men's moods were in a dangerous state. Lieutenant Edward Little, Crozier's executive officer, reported that men on Terra had begun to fashion necklaces and other fetishes from the claws and teeth of some of the white bears they had shot during the summer season. Lieutenant Irving reported weeks ago that Lady Silence had gone into hiding in the forward cable locker, and the men had started leaving portions of their rum and food rations down there in the hold, as if making offerings to a witch or saint in hopes of intercession.
"I've been thinking about your ball," said FitzJames as Crozier began bundling up to leave.
"My ball?"
"The grand Venetian carnival that Hoppner set up when you wintered over with Parry," continued FitzJames. "When you went as a black footman."
"What about it?" asked Crozier, as he bound his comforter around his neck and face.
"Sir John had three large trunks of masks, clothing, and costumes," said FitzJames. "I found them among his personal stores."
"He did?" Crozier was surprised. The aging windbag who would have held divine service six times a week if he had been allowed, and who, despite his frequent laughter, never seemed to understand anyone else's jokes, seemed like the last sort of expedition commander to load trunks of frivolous costumes the way the stage-struck Parry had.
"They're old," confirmed FitzJames. "Some of them may have belonged to Parry and Hoppner. May have been the same costumes you chose from while frozen in Baffin Bay 24 years ago. But there are over 100 tattered rags in there."
Crozier stood bundled in the doorway of Sir John's former cabin, where the two captains had held their sotto voce meeting. He wished FitzJames would get to the point.
"I thought we might hold a mask for the men soon," said FitzJames. "Nothing as fancy as your grand Venetian carnival, of course, not with the unpleasantness out on the ice, but a diversion nonetheless."
"Perhaps," said Crozier,
allowing his tone to convey his lack of enthusiasm at the idea.
"We shall discuss it after this accursed divine service on Sunday."
"Yes, of course,"
FitzJames said hurriedly. His slight lisp became more pronounced when he was nervous.
"Shall I send some men to escort you back to Terra, Captain Crozier?"
"No, and turn in early tonight, James. You look fagged out. We'll both need our energy if we're to properly sermonize the assembled crew on Sunday."
FitzJames smiled dutifully. Crozier thought it a wan and strangely disturbing expression. On Sunday the 5th of December, 1847, Crozier left behind a skeleton crew of six men, commanded by First Lieutenant Edward Little, who, like Crozier, would rather have his kidney stones removed with a spoon than be forced to suffer sermons, as well as his assistant surgeon MacDonald and the engineer James Thompson. The other 50-some surviving crewmen and officers trooped off across the ice, following their captain, Second Lieutenant Hodgson, Third Lieutenant Irving, First Mate Hornby, and the other masters, clerks, and warrant officers. It was almost 10 a.m., but would have been absolutely dark under the shivering stars, except for the return of the aurora, which pulsed, danced, and shifted above them, throwing a long line of their shadows onto the fractured ice. Sergeant Solomon Tozer, the shocking birthmark on his face especially noticeable in the coloured light from the aurora, headed up the guard of Royal Marines with muskets, marching points, flank, and behind the column. But the white thing in the ice left the men alone this Sabbath morning. The last full gathering of both crews for divine service, presided over by Sir John shortly before the creature carried their devout leader down into the darkness under the ice, had been on the open deck
under cold June sunlight. But since it was now at least 50 degrees below zero outside, when the wind was not blowing, Fitzjames had arranged the lower deck for the service. The huge cook stove could not be moved, but the men had cranked up the seamen's dining tables to their maximum height, taken down the removable bulkhead partitions that had delineated the forward sick bay, and removed other partitions that had created the warrant officer's sleeping area, the subordinate officer's steward's cubicle, and the first and second mate's and second master's berths. They also removed the walls of the warrant officer's mess room and assistant surgeon's sleeping room. The space would be crowded still, but adequate. In addition, Fitzjames's carpenter, Mr. Weeks, had created a low pulpit and platform. It was raised only 6 inches because of the lack of headroom under the beams, hanging tables, and stored lumber, but it would allow Crozier and Fitzjames to be seen by the men in the back of the jam of bundled bodies.
"At least we'll be warm,"
Crozier whispered to Fitzjames, as Charles Hamilton Osmer, Erebus's bald purser, led the men in opening hymns. Indeed, the packed bodies had raised the temperature on the lower deck here higher than it had been since Erebus had been burning great heaps of coal and forcing hot water through its heating pipes 6 months earlier. Fitzjames had also tried to lighten up the usually dark and smoky place by burning ship's oil at a furious rate, in no fewer than 10 hanging lamps that lit the space more brightly than at any time since sunlight had poured through the overhead Preston patent illuminators more than 2 years earlier. The crewmen rocked the dark oak beams with their singing. Sailors, Crozier knew from his 40-plus years of experience, loved to sing under almost any circumstance, even if all else failed during divine service. Crozier could see the top of Calker's mate Cornelius Hickey's head in the crowd, while next to him, hunched over so that his head and shoulders would not hit the overhead beams, stood the idiot giant Magnus Manson, who bellowed out the hymn in a boom so off-key that it made the grinding of the ice outside sound like close harmony. The two were sharing one of the tattered hymnals that Purser Osmer had handed out. Finally, the hymns were finished, and there came a low din of shuffling, coughing, and clearing of throats. The air smelled of fresh-baked bread, since Mr. Diggle had come over hours earlier to aid Erebus's cook, Richard Wall, in the baking of biscuits. Crozier and Fitzjames had decided that the extra coal, flour, and lamp oil were worth expending this special day if it helped the men's morale. The darkest 2 months of the Arctic winter were still ahead. Now it was time for the two sermons. Fitzjames had shaved and powdered carefully and allowed his personal steward, Mr. Hoare, to take in his baggy waistcoat, trousers, and jacket, so he looked calm and handsome in his uniform and shining epaulettes. Only Crozier, standing behind him, could see Fitzjames's pale hands clenching and unclenching as he set his personal Bible on the pulpit and opened it to Psalms.
"The reading today shall be from Psalm 46,
said Captain Fitzjames. Crozier winced slightly at the upper-class lisp that had become more pronounced with tension.
"God is our refuge and strength, and ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwelleth. God is within her, she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice, the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he hath brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." The men roared, "Amen,"
and shuffled their warming feet in appreciation. It was Francis Crozier's turn. The men were hushed, as much out of curiosity as respect. The terrors in the assembled mass knew that their captain's idea of a reading for divine service was a solemn recitation of the ship's articles. If a man refuses to obey orders from an officer, that man shall be flogged or put to death, punishment to be determined by the captain. If a man commits sodomy with another member of the crew or a member of the ship's livestock, that man shall be put to death, and so forth. The articles had the proper biblical weight and resonance, and served Crozier's purpose. But not today. Crozier reached to the shelf under the pulpit and pulled out a heavy leather-bound book. He set it down with a reassuring thud of authority.
"Today," he intoned, "I shall read from the book of Leviathan, part 1, chapter 12.
There was a murmuring in the crowd of seamen. Crozier heard a toothless Erebus in the third row mutter,
"I know the fucking Bible, and there ain't no fucking book of Leviathan."
Crozier waited for silence and began.
"And for that part of religion, which consisteth in opinions concerning the nature of powers invisible."
Crozier's voice in Old Testament cadence left no doubt as to which words were celebrated with capital letters.
"There is almost nothing that has a name that has not been esteemed amongst the Gentiles in one place or another. A god or divil, or by their poets feigned to be inanimated, inhabited, or possessed by some spirit or other. The unformed matter of the world was a god by the name of Chaos. The heaven, the ocean, the planets, the fire, the earth, the winds, were so many gods. Men, women, a bird, a crocodile, a calf, a dog, a snake, an onion, a leek, deified. Besides that, they filled almost all places with spirits called daemons, the plains with Pan and Panises or satyrs, the woods with fauns and nymphs, the sea with tritons and other nymphs, every river and fountain with a ghost of his name and with nymphs, every house with its lairs or familiars, every man with his genius, hell with ghosts and spiritual officers, as Charon, Cerberus, and the Furies, and in the night time, all places with larvae, lemures, ghosts of men deceased, and a whole kingdom of fairies and bugbears. They have also ascribed divinity, and built temples to mere accidents and qualities, such as are time, night, day, peace, concord, love, contention, virtue, honour, health, rust, fever, and the like, which when they are prayed for or against, they prayed to as if there were ghosts of those names hanging over their heads and letting fall or withholding that good or evil for or against which they prayed. They invoked also their own wit by the name of muses, their own ignorance by the name of fortune, their own lust by the name of Cupid, their own rage by the name of Furies, their own privy members by the name of Priapus, and attributed their pollutions to incubi and succubae. Insomuch as there is nothing which a poet could introduce as a person in his poem, which they did not make either a god or a divil."
Crozier paused and looked out at the staring white faces.
"And thus endeth part 1, chapter 12 of the Book of Leviathan," he said,
and closed the heavy tome.
"Amen,"
chorused the happy seamen. The men ate hot biscuits and full rations of their beloved salt pork at dinner that afternoon. The extra 40-some terrors crowded around the lowered tables forward or using casks for surfaces and extra sea chests for chairs. The din was reassuring. All of the officers from both ships ate aft, sitting around the long table in Sir John's former cabin. Besides their required antisorbutic lemon juice that day, Dr. MacDonald was now fretting that the 5-gallon kegs were losing their potency, the seamen each received an extra gill of grog before dinner. Captain Fitzjames had dipped into his reserve ship's stores and provided the officers and warrant officers with 3 fine bottles of Madeira and 2 of brandy. At about 3 p.m. civilian time, the Terrors bundled up, wished their Erebus counterparts goodbye, and went up the main ladder, out under the frozen canvas, and then down the snow and ice embankment onto the dark ice for the long walk home under the still shimmering aurora. There were whispers and muted comments in the ranks about the Leviathan sermon. The majority of men were certain that it was in the Bible somewhere, but wherever it had come from, no one was quite sure what their captain had been getting at. Although opinions ran strong after the double ration of rum, many of the men still fingered their good luck fetishes of white bear teeth, claws, and paws. Crozier, who headed up the column, felt half certain that they would return to find Edward Little and the watch murdered, Dr. MacDonald in pieces, and Mr. Thompson the engineer dismembered and strewn about the pipes and valves of his useless steam engine. All was well. Lieutenants Hodgson and Irving handed out the parcels of biscuits and meat that had been warm when they'd left Erebus the better part of an hour earlier. The men who had remained on watch in the cold took their extra rations of grog first. Although he was chilled through, the relative heat of Erebus's crowded lower deck had made the outside cold worse somehow. Crozier stayed on deck until the watch was relieved. The officer on duty was now Thomas Blanky, the ice master. Crozier knew that the men below would be doing Sunday make and mend, many already looking forward to afternoon tea and then supper with its sad fare of poor John, salted and boiled codfish with a biscuit, with the hopes that there might be an ounce of cheese to go with their half pint of Burton's ale. The wind was coming up, blowing snow across the Serac-strewn ice fields on this side of the huge berg, blocking the view of Erebus to the northeast. Clouds were hiding the aurora and stars. The afternoon night became much darker. Eventually, thinking of the whiskey in his cabin, Crozier went below.